We've gotten mixed up with whether or not Alaska Natives are entitled to something from the federal government and whether this is the best mechanism to deliver it.
The Senate looks at federal contracting preferences for Alaska Native corporations. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, the 16th of July. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a call to expand the special session.
Alaskans pay some of the highest motor fuel prices in the nation. And on September 1st, those gas prices are going to rise even more in Alaska.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by the Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, operating and maintaining the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, and by First National Bank Alaska, serving Alaskans' financial needs for nearly a century, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
Alaska Native Corporations' special right to get no-bid federal contracts came under scrutiny today on Capitol Hill. A subcommittee on contracting oversight examined the Small Business Administration's 8A program, which gives socially and economically disadvantaged businesses a leg up in securing contracts. Tribal, Alaska Native, and Hawaiian organizations get special opportunities. Missouri Senator Claire McCaskill called for the hearing, and as APRN's Libby Casey reports, she had some strong criticisms of the program.
The room for the hearing on preferences given to Alaska Native corporations was packed. People stood in line for hours to get a seat, and dozens of Alaskans flew down to Washington just to attend. Many of them represent Native corporations that benefit from the Small Business Administration's 8A program, and they've waged a campaign on Capitol Hill this week to get their opinions heard. Despite the intense interest, only a handful of members of Congress were on hand. Senator McCaskill invited Alaska's senators to participate, and the three of them dominated the questioning, McCaskill critical of the contracts and Alaska senators defending them. McCaskill used to be a state auditor and kicked off the hearing by listing her concerns.
We want these small businesses to be able to get their foot in the door. But the Alaska Native corporations have used their special preferences to bust the door down.
Contracts for the Alaska Native corporations expanded from just over $500 million in the year 2000 to more than $5 billion last year. But McCaskill says that only sent home about $615 per shareholder. She pointed to a recent Inspector General report that showed 26% of all contract dollars for disadvantaged businesses around the country went to Alaska Native corporations. Deborah Ritt from the IG's office says the biggest advantage given to the Native corporations is the ability to get sole source awards of any value. They're exempt from competitive thresholds placed on other businesses in the program, and they never outgrow it. Ritt says that may be hurting other small businesses.
ANC companies are receiving a disproportionate share of the 8A obligations. Also, the procurement advantages that they enjoy and their ability to access capital and credit through their parent companies may be working to disadvantage other 8A participants.
The IG report recommends that the Small Business Administration review the impacts Native corporations are having on other businesses, and it says the advantages given to them should be re-examined. The report also recommends more oversight of the contract awards by better staffing the Alaska District Office, which has only a few employees. Concerns about squeezing out other businesses from contracts were echoed by the chief financial officer of a contractor based in upstate New York. Christina Schneider says her firm, Purcell Construction, wasn't given a chance to compete for a vital contract at the local Army post. Instead, it went to Chugach and Aludic.
Our firm and several other general contractors in northern New York were totally shut out from competing for this contract. We were given various reasons for this decision, ranging from there not being enough time to procure this contract using traditional methods to the unbelievable argument that this sole source contract would lead to the most potential for involvement by local companies.
No heads of Alaska Native corporations were invited to testify, but Julie Kitka, president of the Alaska Federation of Natives, was added to the witness list at the request of Alaska's senators. She emphasized the positive ripple effect the contracts have and told the senators that Alaska Natives are getting the intended benefits out of the program.
The scholarships, the internship opportunities, the work opportunities are real. Are there improvements that can be done? Of course there's improvements that can be done. But there's many other factors that need to be in place to help our Native population, to grow our workforce, in these contracting opportunities and in other sectors.
Sarah Lukeen is executive director of the Native American Contractors Association in Washington, but grew up in the small Kodiak Island community of Port Lyons. She says she was disheartened to hear the program described as a loophole.
That term ignores the reality of our severe socioeconomic disadvantages. The fact that Native enterprises are owned by Native communities that are destitute and geographically isolated, decimated by centuries of failed federal policies, yet are still responsible for the health and welfare of thousands of their people, their descendants and dependents, that's real.
As the hearing closed after nearly 3 hours of testimony and questioning, Senator McCaskill acknowledged the unique struggles and challenges Alaska Natives face. But she said she still wants to see the corporations work without sole source contracts. McCaskill said they've gotten too big and powerful to be given such an advantage.
The question is, how long will we continue to have a preference in the law that squeezes out good companies like Christina Schneider's, and lots of companies in many, many states in this country that have the willingness to work for the government for less to provide the same service? And that's really what this is about. And I think we've gotten mixed up with whether or not Alaska Natives are entitled to something from the federal government and whether this is the best mechanism to deliver it.
McCaskill said she's concerned overall with a lack of competitiveness in government contracting. And while this is just one piece of the puzzle, it's one she intends to keep looking at. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
Lieutenant Governor Sean Parnell has asked State House and Senate leaders to extend the planned one-day special session on August 10th in Anchorage.
Alaskans pay some of the highest motor fuel prices in the nation. And on September 1st, those gas prices are going to rise even more in Alaska when a one-year suspension of the state motor fuel tax expires. And so I am calling on legislators to extend or even repeal the motor fuel tax suspension with most of them, as well as other legislators, and ask their support in expanding the call of their special session to include taking this up.
The measure would suspend the 8-cent a gallon motor fuel tax 2 more years. The brief session was initially called to deal with 2 specific issues. However, Senate President Gary Stevens says legislative leaders will discuss Parnell's request. Stevens does agree there is an unlimited agenda when the legislature calls itself into session. And while other subjects could come up, Stevens says this particular session was designed to limit itself, and he has already turned down requests from other senators to expand the call.
The reason we're having it in Anchorage, frankly, is a concern on the part of the House members that they'd be able to do it all in one day and leave that evening for home. So since that is the case, we're just not going to be able to get into any long-involved consideration of bills that were stuck last session.
The first issue legislators plan to meet on is the confirmation of Commissioner of Military and Veterans Affairs Craig Campbell as the new lieutenant governor. House Rules Chairman John Coghill says the quick confirmation of Campbell is necessary on the outside chance something were to happen to the new governor.
That would take the legislature into a very awkward place, and it would put Alaska in probably some legal entanglements that we just have to work through. The timing of it was very important that we go ahead and just discharge that.
The other reason for the one-day session is to vote on whether to override Governor Palin's budget vetoes, particularly her rejection of $28 million in federal stimulus money to address energy needs. Senate President Stevens says he has enough votes to override the energy stimulus veto. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Juneau struggles to attract big retailers.
You'd really be coming in and trying to gobble up a piece of a pretty small pie, and a pie that hasn't been growing over the last decade or so.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo, with scheduled flights to 16 destinations throughout Alaska every week. Northern Air Cargo, building strong relationships with the communities they serve.
Air pollution experts from around the country are assembled in Fairbanks this week for a symposium aimed at unraveling the community's fine particulate problem. Wildfire smoke has elevated local particulate levels this week, but as KUAC's Dan Bross reports, the symposium is focused on human-generated emissions from heating, power production, and vehicles.
On the coldest days of winter, the still, frigid conditions trap smoke near the ground in Fairbanks, making for dangerously poor air quality. Fairbanks began regularly violating federal particulate emission standards after the Environmental Protection Agency tightened them to reflect research showing serious health consequences of breathing in the tiny particles that result from combustion. State Environmental Public Health Manager Lori Verbrugge says fine particulate pollution should be taken seriously.
If a city has a higher particulate matter load than another city, particularly if it's in the higher ranges, that directly translates into higher death rates in your community, especially among people who have heart disease, but even among people who don't know that they're sensitive. There's more heart attacks, there's more heart events, as well as respiratory events.
Verbrugge says fine particulates do not remain in the lungs long term and are not linked to cancer. Fairbanks typically violates air quality standards during extreme cold snaps, and the borough has been monitoring local emissions to try to quantify sources like wood, coal, and oil burning. There are two kinds of particulates: primary, those produced directly by burning, and secondary, those created by chemical processes in the atmosphere. Regional EPA scientist Krishna Viswanathan says unique conditions in Fairbanks have raised new questions about how secondary particles form.
Our understanding was that the right conditions involved sunlight, photochemical transformation. And the complexity here is that in Fairbanks, there is no sunlight in the winter when we find these high values. So what is the chemical process that happens? Yeah, so we're trying to study that. We're trying to understand that.
Viswanathan says another unique aspect of the Fairbanks problem is multiple inversion layers that trap pollutants at varying levels in the atmosphere during cold weather. Researchers are working the issues, but in the meantime, the borough is moving ahead on measures to reduce the output from primary emission sources. Borough Mayor Jim Whitaker is behind an ordinance that will require and help residents pay for replacement of polluting wood stoves.
There is a tax credit as well as a one-time cash payment relative to changing heating devices, meaning that it's a... if there is an old dirty wood stove that can be changed out for a clean burning wood stove, then there is financial support for that.
Whitaker says the ordinance due out this week taps $1.9 million in economic stimulus money and another million from the borough's general fund. He says people who use wood as their only heat source will not be required to participate in the program, but that it's a good opportunity to upgrade your wood stove. Vehicle exhaust is another source of fine particulates, but Borough Transportation Manager Glenn Miller says an inspection and maintenance program like the one currently being phased out for carbon monoxide is not in the works.
Even if we found that mobile sources are a significant contributor, I think that we would probably be looking at a different set group of vehicles than we currently are. Specifically diesel power vehicles, heavy duty diesel power vehicles, those types of things, because that is known to contribute more than gasoline powered vehicles.
Miller says a study will be conducted in Fairbanks to monitor fine particulate output from a variety of vehicle types to better nail down how much they contribute to the problem. The Borough Air Quality Symposium continues through Friday at the Alpine Lodge with a number of technical presentations on the agenda. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
A month and a half after Gottschalk's closed its doors, Juneau shoppers are still wondering what will fill its 32,000-square-foot shoes in the Mendenhall Mall. Gottschalk's Incorporated filed for bankruptcy in mid-January. In June, Macy's and Forever 21 bought or took over the leases of a number of locations nationwide. As soon as the company knew it was going under, the Juneau Gottschalks terminated its month-to-month lease, so the space remains empty. But if and when a new business does move in, what would it take for it to succeed in the capital city in the current economy? KTOO's Rebecca Shear set out to find out.
Mendenhall Mall manager Larry Bauer knows what he'd like to see take over those 32,000 square feet.
The Burlington Coat Factory was what I would really like, or Kohl's. I think they would do very well here in Juneau.
There's just one itty-bitty problem.
Unfortunately, neither one of them are interested right now, and we have spoken to them.
Bauer attributes the lack of interest to one main factor.
Demographics. The population.
Larry Bauer's 25 years in real estate have taught him that most stores, and we're talking box stores here, massive retail establishments, usually part of a national chain.
They want to have 100 to 200,000 people within a certain radius of 5-10 miles maybe. In Juneau, and you have 30,000 people, it's hard for them to justify coming with their size store.
And according to Jim Calvin of local research and consulting firm McDowell Group, the capital city isn't getting any bigger.
Our population hasn't grown for really the last 7 or 8 years.
Neither, he says, have salaries.
Personal income is barely keeping up with inflation. Our wages and salaries in our most important industry, state government, have really declined in real terms over the last 10 to 15 years.
So, as Calvin puts it, if you were a retailer with your sights set on Juneau,
you'd really be coming in and trying to gobble up a piece of a pretty small pie, and a pie that hasn't been growing over the last decade or so.
Plus, he says, even if you do try and gobble that pie, there are a number of things you might, well, choke on. First off,
there's always the freight challenges. It costs money to get goods to Juneau.
Since, of course, you have just two choices, air or water. Most retail goods come twice a week by barge. So given Juneau's location and the price of fuel, per unit freight costs can be relatively high. Another challenge, Calvin says, is competition.
There's some well-established businesses in town, and if the market's not growing, then what you have to do is take business away from existing businesses.
Then, of course, there's figuring out what the market demands.
You see some strange things show up in the big box stores when they first open, like, well, okay, that's not going to work very well in Juneau, but they learn that eventually.
That's all part of that formula where they boom, just shotgun out the same merchandise assortment to every store, regardless of where it is. And I think now as computer programs get better, they'll stop doing that. You won't see so many snake bite kits on the shelves here.
Ron Flint manages one of those established businesses Jim Calvin mentioned.
Nugget Alaskan Outfitter here in the Nugget Mall.
Another Mendenhall Valley shopping center, incidentally, with a vacancy to fill.
We have a big old empty space down where the Nugget department store used to be.
Flint's dad opened the department store at the end of the mall in 1974. They eventually relocated to where Nugget Alaskan stands today. The store has developed a loyal following, but Flint acknowledges that running a small business in Juneau hasn't been easy.
The store definitely is a pretty good barometer of the local economy. It's slowed down a little bit lately. It hit us last October. By then, everybody's 401k had been taking a pretty big hit, and everybody was feeling a little bit less prosperous.
Still, Flint says he'd like to see more new businesses come to his hometown.
Not REI, but it helps make Juneau more of a regional center retail-wise, and it keeps jobs here.
And that's another reason Mendenhall manager Larry Bauer is so antsy to fill those 32,000 square feet. Granted, every day the space remains empty, he's not making any cash. But more important, he says, the right tenant could help Juneau and the region flourish.
And it's part of my job to convince them that they're not just a draw for Juneau, but for Southeast Alaska. People from Sitka and Ketchikan and all over Southeast come to the shop here in Juneau.
Bauer says several box tenants have expressed interest in evaluating the Juneau market. The National Retail Federation, the world's largest retail trade association, says such an assessment is typical and can take anywhere from 3 to 7 years as retailers analyze demographics and disposable income and negotiate land lease deals. But with an open lease at Mendenhall Mall, Larry Bauer predicts he could have a new tenant in as little as 6 months. It all depends, of course, on who's willing to take a bite of that pie. In Juneau, I'm Rebecca Shear.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. Begin your UAF fisheries degree at any major University of Alaska campus and finish in Fairbanks or Juneau. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
Alaskans' opinions remain mixed about plans for new ferries without staterooms, but officials say more comfortable seats and quiet rooms will answer many of the concerns. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
The Marine Highway System is planning several new ferries that will cover short to medium length sailings. Southeast routes could include Lynn Canal, Prince Rupert to Ketchikan, and Sitka to Juneau. What are called Alaska Class ferries could also serve Whittier, Valdez, and Cordova. Officials say nothing is final and plans and cost estimates are still in the works, but they're firm that the ships will not include private passenger cabins. That's been somewhat controversial. Juneau's Patrick Owen serves on the state's Marine Transportation Advisory Board. At a recent meeting, the former ferry employee said he frequently saw the need for staterooms.
We had payoff parties in the fall where sometimes the people would be up 24 hours at these parties, and they would come aboard ship and they needed something to lay down, and these were older people. And a couple of times we had to haul them off, and one passed away from that, and another one was in real bad shape.
Officials say the ships will not sail overnight. That makes staterooms a luxury too expensive to include. Ferry Chief Jim Beadle told the group adding cabins would require a larger boat and almost double the staff. He said it could increase operating costs by about $100,000 a week. But Beadle says designers are not ignoring the need. One solution is to develop more comfortable chairs.
These are going to recline a lot further than our present chairs and have footrests on them, we hope, and be pretty darn comfortable so that you can actually go to sleep in them and be comfortable when you do that.
Designers are also planning for what are called quiet rooms. They'll include a bed-sized padded bench and other amenities, but Beadle says they'll not be for general use.
And it won't be, you know, just for somebody that says, I'd like to take a nap, but for somebody fresh out of the hospital or an elderly person or somebody in a cast or somebody with a crying baby, there's all kinds of things. And instead of letting them disturb everybody else on board, one of the crew members can open the door and say, here, just have your privacy. When you get things under control or you feel better, then come on out and join us.
Details are not final. But construction manager Robert Eske told the board that plans call for 4 to 6 quiet rooms per vessel. Advisory board members said they wanted to know more about the quiet rooms before the design is finished. Gerald Hope of Sitka says they should not be too frugal.
Our elders would be probably the most common person that would stay. We want to make sure that they're taken care of comfortably.
A third of those responding to a recent survey said they liked the plan. Close to a fifth said it was not a concern. But another fifth did not like the plan, and just under a third said they didn't like it but could accept it. Construction manager Eske says that's enough support.
They may not agree with it. They may not agree with the motion. However, they understand why we're doing it.
Officials have toured the Alaska Class Ferry project around port cities, and they say they'll continue to seek input as details firm up. The design is expected to be complete by March 30th of next year. This is Ed Schoenfeld reporting from Juneau.
The Denali climbing season has ended, and all climbers are off the mountain. The season wasn't without incidents, but there were fewer major issues compared to last year. KTNA's Sue Dio has the story.
A total of 1,163 people registered to climb Denali this year. 682 climbers successfully summited. That gives Denali a summit success rate of 59%. The other popular mountain, Foraker, had 15 people registered and a total of 8 summited. After Daryl Miller retired last year, there were a number of people who wondered who could fill the shoes of the South District Ranger that had been an integral part of the climbing community for so many years. Lead climbing ranger John Leonard stepped in as acting district ranger while a search continued for someone to fill the role permanently. He said one of the challenges facing the staff this season was the decision of NPS not to renew the contract with the Llama helicopter. The beginning of the season was a big question in many minds, as the park's decision was to go with an unknown, an A-Star B-3, and a new pilot instead of the Llama and its pilot.
Both the helicopter and the pilot, I think, far exceeded our expectations. And I just recently landed on the top of the mountain during some flight testing. Yeah, though the pilot that we had hadn't had a lot of experience in Alaska Range previous to this season. He did great, now has quite a bit of experience, and flew about 100 hours total this season and got quite a bit of experience and just did a superb job.
The rescue vehicle plays a large part in the season, Leonard adds. There were 4 deaths this year on the mountain, one that led to an 8-day search. A doctor disappeared on the West Buttress after he left his climbing party to climb a day on his own. Although the search for someone presumed dead is not fun, the search for the missing doctor this year led to solving the mysterious disappearance of 2 Japanese climbers from last year.
Going back and then now knowing where they were exactly, we were able to take and look at pictures of that same area that we took last year, and they kind of jump out of the picture. And it sort of validated the process that, I mean, literally within our first 10 pictures last year of our search, they were in there. However, we couldn't zoom in enough because of the quality of the image to actually see them. They just showed up as 2 rocks.
Rarely would people think that technological advances can change mountain climbing. However, Leonard says it made a difference this year in search and recovery.
Our searching method we utilize using high-resolution cameras. And last year, technology allowed us to use about a 12-megapixel camera. This year, with advances in technology, we were able to get up to 21 megapixels. So not exactly doubling the image quality, but improving it quite a bit.
Accidents aside, Leonard says the Wounded Warrior Project was one of the brightest spots in the season when a team of wounded veterans were able to summit Denali. The other bright side was the weather.
Last year we had probably the highest year in frostbite that we've ever had. This year we had just a couple cases of pretty minor frostbite. 59% of the climbers attempt to climb Denali summited. Yeah, it's a big, big number. And weather-wise, it was just a great year. And really, that's a lot of what sets the tone.
The ashfall from the Mount Readout explosion was a question earlier, but he says climbers weren't too affected.
It didn't seem to make a huge difference for climbers this year. It did make a difference for air taxis, and the airstrips went out of condition earlier than normal.
He believes that next year will be the telling point with the ashfall. Leonard says the search for a permanent South District Ranger will continue, and he expects to be in his ongoing role as lead climbing ranger next summer. In Talkeetna, I'm Sue Dio.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Rebecca Shear and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, and Sue Dio in Talkeetna. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. Our intern is Susanna Caldwell, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by the UAF College of Engineering and Mines, providing early registration for fall engineering classes at 1-877-474-7390. Information at uaf.edu/CEM. Guess who teens say is their most important influence when it comes to sex? Their parents. Listen up. Teens want to know what you think, even if they don't act like it. Talk with your teens about sex, love, and values. Nationwide, 1 out of every 3 girls gets pregnant at least once by age 20. Make sure your daughter isn't one of them. Visit stayteen.org for special parent tips and more information on how you can prevent teen pregnancy. This message is sponsored by the State of Alaska Department of Health and Social Services. Didn't quite catch that report? Want to hear it again? APRN can be heard on the web at www.aprn.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.